Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
President Donald Trump says he wants to end the constitutional right of citizenship for babies born in the United States to non-U.S. citizens. Trump made the comments on the television program Axios on HBO. They come a week before general elections, also called midterm elections. The name comes from the fact that they come halfway through the president's four-year term in office. The Associated Press reports that the president wants to energize his supporters and help the Republican Party keep control of Congress. Trump has expressed concern about a large group of Central American migrants walking across Mexico toward the U.S. border. On Monday, the Trump administration announced it is sending thousands of troops to the border area. The president has said he will build tent cities for those seeking asylum.
For years, Trump and many U.S. conservatives have called for an end to birthright citizenship. One idea is for the president to sign an executive order to suspend that constitutional right. But it is not clear if a president has the power to declare that children born in the United States to those living here illegally are not citizens. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution guarantees that right for all children born in the United States. When asked if he had the power to make such a change, Trump said, "They're saying I can do it with just an executive order." He added that, "We are the only country in the world where a person comes in and has a baby, and the baby is a citizen of the United States." A 2010 study from the Center for Immigration Studies showed that 30 countries offered birthright citizenship.
Some of Trump's recent comments were published Tuesday on Axios's website. The president said that government lawyers are studying his proposal. It is unclear how quickly he would act on the executive order. A person close to the Trump White House said the issue of birthright citizenship had been raised many times during the past year. However, some White House officials reportedly expressed opposition to any change. White House lawyers will work with the Justice Department to develop a legal justification for the action, the person said. The person added that it is one of many immigration policy changes being discussed. But administration officials said no changes will be made until after the elections next week.
Legal experts questioned whether Trump has the power to make such changes with an executive order. Omar Jadwat is the director of the Immigrants' Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union in New York. He noted that the U.S. Constitution is very clear. If you are born in the United States, you're a citizen, he said. He added that it was outrageous that the president can think he can override constitutional guarantees by issuing an executive order. Jadhvat said the president is required to defend the Constitution. He added that Trump can try to get Congress to pass a constitutional amendment, but he said, "I don't think they are anywhere close to getting that. Any decision by Congress would end up in court," Jadhvat said. Susanna Sherry is a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School in Tennessee. She told the Associated Press that people who are telling Trump he can change the Constitution with an executive order are mistaken. He can't do it by himself, she said, adding that he cannot do it even if Congress agrees. Sherry said, "I think it would take a constitutional amendment."
Under the Constitution, an amendment may be proposed by the Congress with a two-thirds majority vote in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, or two-thirds of state legislatures must call for a special meeting or constitutional convention. But other experts say the U.S. president may have the power to end birthright citizenship. John Feary is an advisor at Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He has argued that the president could limit citizenship through an executive order. Feary wrote that a president could direct the government to follow his interpretation of the Supreme Court's past rulings. The court has only ruled on the children of legal immigrants. It has not ruled on the children of those asking for asylum or those who are in the country illegally. Feary also wrote that a president could tell the government to give Social Security numbers and passports only to children who have at least one parent who is a citizen, or parents who are in the United States legally. His argument was published in The Hill in 2015.
The first line of the 14th Amendment states that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. Congress passed the 14th Amendment in 1866, after the Civil War. It was agreed to by three-fourths of the states in 1868. At the time, the amendment was seen as a way to guarantee citizenship to freed slaves and their children.
The number of English language learners in American public schools continues to rise. About 9.5% of public school students were English language learners in 2015, the U.S. Department of Education reports. That was about 4.8 million students across the country. That number had risen from 8.1%, or 3.8 million students, in 2000. The department's National Center for Education Statistics said. The results were also reported by the Pew Research Center. English language learners, also known as ELLs, are students with limited English abilities. American public school systems seek to identify these students and develop programs to help them improve their English. The goal is to give students the language skills they need to fully take part in educational activities and help them succeed in the classroom. Studies have shown clear links between English language proficiency and improved educational results. The state with the highest number of ELL students is California. 21% of its public school students were English language learners in 2015. The next highest states were Texas and Nevada. Nearly 17% of both states' students were ELLs. In 8 states, ELLs made up 10% or more of the total public school students. 36 states and the District of Columbia saw a rise in the number of ELL students from 2010 to 2015. The largest increase, 3%, was reported in Massachusetts. In 14 states, the percentage of ELLs fell in 2015 compared to 2010. The largest drop, which was 4%, was reported in the western state of Nevada. Spanish is by far the most common language spoken at home by ELLs. About 77% of the students said they mainly spoke Spanish at home, the language report said. 21% of Spanish-speaking ELLs live in California. Arabic is the second most common language spoken at home by ELL students. Across America, 2.4% of English learners reported speaking mainly Arabic at home. But that percentage was much higher in some U.S. states. For example, about 24% of ELLs reported speaking Arabic at home in the northern state of Michigan. Chinese is the third most commonly spoken language by American ELL students. About 2% of the total, or about 101,000 students, identified themselves as Chinese speakers at home. Pew's report also noted that across all 50 states, Chinese is among the 5 most common languages spoken by ELLs. Vietnamese is the 4th most common language. About 81,000 ELL students reported speaking Vietnamese at home. That is 1.7% of all ELLs. In Hawaii and Alaska, however, the most common language spoken by the state's ELLs were none of the major languages reported across the country. Instead, the most commonly spoken languages match each state's main immigrant or indigenous populations, the Migration Policy Institute reported. In Hawaii, 21% of students reported speaking Ilocano, a language native to the Philippines. In Alaska, 40% reported speaking Yupik, a family of languages used by the Yupik indigenous population. About 14% of ELLs live in cities, the National Center for Education Statistics reported. 9% live in suburban areas, and around 6.5% lived in small towns, while 3.6% were in rural areas. Not surprisingly, most English language learners were in lower grade levels. In 2015, 67% of students were either in kindergarten or grades 1 through 5. The other 33% were in 6th through 12th grades. However, 62% of American public school districts reported having at least some high school English language learners. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Dwight Eisenhower. He took office in 1953 and was re-elected in 1956. Eisenhower was famous before he became President of the United States. He was a general in World War II and led the Allied invasion of Europe. The attack began with the air and sea operation called D-Day. As president, Eisenhower became known for his efforts to keep peace. He tried to have good relations with the Soviet Union especially. He believed one of the best ways to do that was to build America's military strength. When Americans think of Eisenhower, they often note the growth of the U.S. defense industry and tensions with the Soviet Union. Those tensions became known as the Cold War and lasted long after Eisenhower left office. Dwight David Eisenhower was born in Texas, but raised in the state of Kansas. His parents had 7 sons. The future president was the 3rd. Eisenhower's parents did not have much money. His father worked as a mechanic. His mother was a member of the Mennonite Church, which opposed war and violence for any reason. But young Dwight, who used the nickname Ike, enjoyed reading about military history and doing physical activities. He played football and liked hunting and fishing. When he finished high school, Eisenhower earned a position at the U.S. Military Academy, better known as West Point. At first, he did not excel as a soldier. Eisenhower tested some of the Army's traditional ideas. But in time, military leaders came to value Eisenhower's ability to think independently and strategically. He accepted increasingly important positions. In only a few years, Eisenhower took command of Allied troops during World War II. He directed invasions in North Africa, Italy, and finally in Western Europe. His words, "Okay, let's go," launched the invasion of Normandy, France, on June 6, 1944. Eisenhower's personal life changed during his military years. He married a young woman named Mamie Dowd in 1916. The following year, they had a son named Dowd Dwight. However, the boy became sick and died at the age of 3. In 1922, the Eisenhowers had a second son named John. Mamie and the boy spent many months separated from Dwight. And even when the family was together, they were often moving from place to place. They moved nearly 30 times during Eisenhower's military career. After he retired from active duty in the Army, Eisenhower accepted a position as president of Columbia University in New York. Then he returned to the military to lead NATO forces in Europe. In the early 1950s, Republican Party officials urged Eisenhower to be their candidate for president. Many Americans approved of Eisenhower's war record, his efforts to contain communism, and his wide smile. They seemed to agree with his campaign slogan, "I like Ike," and decisively elected him into office. His 1952 election brought an end to the Democratic Party's 20-year control of the White House. Although he declared himself a Republican, Eisenhower was a political moderate in many of his ideas. He continued some of the domestic policies of former presidents Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Eisenhower also wanted the government to invest in public works projects. Notably, he approved a bill to build more than 65,000 kilometers of roads. Today, the U.S. highway system connects all parts of the country and supports the nation's economy. Eisenhower also worked hard to have peaceful relations with other countries. In his first months as president, he signed the agreement that ended fighting in the Korean War. He also tried to ease tensions between the United States and Soviet Union. In 1952, the U.S. government tested the first hydrogen bomb. It was even more powerful than the atomic bomb. Soon, the Soviet Union carried out a hydrogen bomb test of its own. The two countries became actively involved in an arms race that made many people around the world very, very nervous. Eisenhower did not fully trust the Soviet leadership, but made some efforts to achieve an agreement on arms control. At the same time, he approved a plan for U.S. airplanes to fly secretly over the Soviet Union to gather information. In 1959, Eisenhower and the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, met in the American state of Maryland. Modern presidents use a mountain retreat there, which Eisenhower called Camp David, after his grandson. The U.S. and Soviet officials did not develop a treaty, but they did agree to meet again the following year. However, the agreement collapsed. In 1960, Soviet missiles brought down one of the American spy planes, called a U-2. The pilot was captured. At first, Eisenhower's government denied that the plane was secretly gathering information. Officials said it was only a weather aircraft. But then the Soviets produced evidence that the U-2 was, in fact, a spy plane. Khrushchev said he could not trust Eisenhower and his government, and he ended talks on limiting or disarming nuclear weapons. During his two terms in office, Eisenhower tried many ways to avoid all-out war. He approved other secret actions, especially by the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA. Eisenhower sent U.S. Marines into Lebanon to try to end unrest there, and he decided against ordering airstrikes on Viet Minh forces when they surrounded French troops at Dien Bien Phu, Vietnam. In all these efforts, Eisenhower used the threat of U.S. military power to help achieve his foreign policy goals. But he warned Americans against letting businesses aiding the defense industry become too powerful. In his final speech as president, Eisenhower spoke of the dangers of what he called the military-industrial complex. He did not want the country to depend only on war to resolve conflicts. And he did not want the U.S. government to spend so much on weapons that it could not provide other services to Americans. Shortly after that speech, Eisenhower retired to a home he and his wife had bought in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Many Americans were sad to see him go. Eisenhower's presidency lasted most of the 1950s. During that time, the American economy was, for the most part, strong. Many Americans had enough money to buy homes and televisions. At the same time, Eisenhower's presidency was a time of unease. Racial discrimination was intense. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court declared that states could no longer have separate public schools for white and black students. Some whites strongly objected to the decision. They tried to block black students from entering schools, sometimes using violence. Eisenhower sent troops to enforce the federal law to desegregate public schools. Later, Eisenhower used the power of his office to enforce other desegregation and voting rights laws. But he did not speak up strongly in support of civil rights. He thought both those who blocked civil rights legislation and those who demanded it were extreme. Eisenhower also did not publicly criticize Senator Joseph McCarthy, who accused the U.S. government of protecting Soviet spies. Eisenhower strongly disliked McCarthy, but he permitted the Red Scare to continue until the lawmaker could discredit himself. Finally, despite Eisenhower's efforts, the Cold War did not end. In fact, tensions between the U.S. and Soviet Union increased. Although Eisenhower succeeded in keeping the country out of war, many events during his presidency created the conditions for later conflicts. Nevertheless, Eisenhower was a popular president both before, during, and after his time in office. During his final years, he wrote several books about his life, traveled, and advised later presidents. He had suffered a heart attack during his first term in office and eventually suffered another one. He died at the age of 78 with his family by his side.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.